You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jessica Parker in today for Leonard Lopate. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dexter Filkins is widely considered one of the best war correspondents of his generation. And it's not that difficult to understand why. His reporting from places like Iraq and Afghanistan can unravel the most complex of environments with a raw, remarkable immediacy that it almost feels like you could have been there. His 2008 book, The Forever Wars, was a riveting bestseller. He's currently a writer with The New Yorker, and I am very pleased to welcome him today to The Leonard Lopate Show. Hello, Dexter.
Hi, thank you.
There's so much I want to ask you and know in this brief period that I have with you. But I think what I would like to do is actually kind of start at the beginning. And if you could talk about that first time experience covering conflict and what that was like for you and where you had come from prior.
No, I mean, I covered the county commission in Miami.
A natural leap.
Yeah, natural. Well, actually, it prepared me pretty well. But, it's hard to prepare for this stuff. I think the first real combat I saw was in October 2001. It was right after the 9/11 attacks. And my bosses at the New York Times, I had been to Afghanistan at that point. They said, go, you know, get on a plane and find your way to northern Afghanistan, where that patch of territory where the rebels still hold. And so I did. I got on a plane and I flew to Dushanbe, Tajikistan, and then I rented a bunch of cars and taxis and made my way across the border. Nothing really prepares you for it because I think there's a saying, war is nine parts boredom and one part terror. And that's pretty accurate. It's usually you're just standing around and there's no warning as to when the crazy stuff is going to happen. And then when it happens, it's crazy and you got to be careful and you got to try to keep your head about you. So, it started like that. It was before, you know, I was there in October 2001. I was there when the first American B-52 strikes came in. So that's when it all started.
And so when you're on that flight to that remote place, and you have no experience to call upon. You've never been, you know, I always think of like a director. When a young person wants to be a director, they shadow a director for a while, or even a waitress is given shifts to shadow. You've not had any of those experiences. So you're on the plane, and what's going through your mind? And how do you know you've got to get taxis? You've got to, all the minutia that adds up to a really important story in the New York Times. How do you know what to do? Is it just an intrepid instinct you have, or?
In a situation like that, you're constantly improvising, and it helps if you have, as I did at the time, a bag of cash, like an enormous bag
well,
of cash.
Who told you to do that?
Tens, you know, like $10,000 with me. And when you have, a big garbage bag full of $100 bills, it's remarkable.
The influence.
How many things, will start happening for you. So, the truth is you can't really prepare. And I didn't really know what I was getting into. And I've often thought, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? But in that situation, I remember I crossed the Amu Darya River into northern Afghanistan by myself, and I there was nothing. I met a photographer there, James Hill of the New York Times, and we had to find a mud hut to rent. We found one, and it actually had windows. And we found a generator. We had to find gasoline to run the generator. You know, we had to find electric lights. We kind of built like a water heater. There was a well in the yard. It's pretty primal. But
and what language are you using in these conversations with locals to buy a generator, to find a mud hut? Did you speak Arabic? How are you communicating?
That's a great question. You're sort of not communicating, which again, that's when the $100 bills are really persuasive. But the first thing that you have to do, of course, is get a translator. And I remember at the time in northern Afghanistan, it's a really poor area. It makes the rest of Afghanistan look like Switzerland. And I didn't have one. And there were lots of reporters getting there. And so a translator, like qualified as some kid who had taken like two classes of English, and he could say hello and goodbye and thank you. And that's kind of where we started. And it was like, you're hired. Here's $100 a day. And then you just kind of go from there. So you're just trying to, it's like it's not going to come all at once.
And do you think that this is a disposition that you sort of stumbled upon in some way, that this character that is needed, and maybe even this photographer that you met up with, is this something that is in some ways the criteria for a person who does your work? Can you acquire it? Is it like learning to like liver? Do you see people who engage in this work and then you see them pull back and they're not there, and then you see people like yourself who keep returning, or do you not want to talk about the fact that you keep returning?
I don't return as often as I used to, but it's I guess the thing to remember when you're in the middle of this, if you're just an observer, and to stand in the middle of one of these enormous events, it's really exciting. It's really fun. And if anybody tells you it's not fun, that they're just there, bearing witness and all that, it's not true. It's amazing. It's extraordinary. And so, for instance, 2001 in the Afghan War, watching the B-52s come in and the Taliban collapse in the space of a week. They just disintegrated. And the new guys, the Northern Alliance, as they were called at the time, rolling into Kabul and kind of taking over. I mean, that's like you're just breathing pure oxygen. It's extraordinary. And that's kind of what draws you to it. It's not so much, people ask me if you get addicted to the violence. And the answer is no, not at all. That's to be avoided. But what you do get kind of really into is the largeness. It's just your how many times in your life do you get to really feel the continental plates shifting under your feet?
I'm Sarah Jessica Parker, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking, very fortunately, with Dexter Filkins from The New Yorker. So just to get a little bit of perspective too, you're talking about your period at the Times, and now, as I mentioned, you're currently with The New Yorker. Those are different, very different ways of telling stories, I would imagine. One is you're kind of, the guy, the bureau, right? And you're getting breaking news all the time, and you're sort of dictating in some ways what we're learning at home. But how does it work with The New Yorker? Who comes up with story ideas when, for instance, you want to tell the story of, and forgive me if I mispronounce, an incredible piece. It was last September, I think, 2013. And it's about this amazing story about really one of the most influential but hidden men, right, in Iran? I'm sorry. No,
Iran.
Yeah, yeah. So that story is this big, lush, really kind of almost, it seems like a novel, like fiction. Who brings that story to David, or David? How do you start talking about that, and how that must be a very different process than covering news at the Times?
Yes. Yeah. When you cover news, it's just like when you're at the Times and on a big story, it's just kind of rock and roll all the time, and you feel like you have no time. Like you're writing stories even before the event is over, and particularly now. With the internet, if you go to a car bombing, your cell phone's going to ring, and it's going to be the rewrite guy in Paris asking you to describe what you're seeing. I mean, that's how fast
wow.
it is. So it's
wow.
crazy, and you're like, hold on, I'm not even there yet.
Wait a minute, we're going to talk about your cell phone in a minute. We'll get to that, if you know what I mean.
But to answer your question, I mean, it's best to explain these things by example, but I did that story on Qasem Soleimani, who is the very, as you say, very powerful, very shadowy. He's essentially the head of, it's called the Quds Force, but it's basically the head of Iranian intelligence, and they're kind of all over the region. And it was one of these things where it was really just a hunch. I kept hearing his name in conversations. I was in Beirut, and I was having dinner with this Lebanese politician, and he said, Qasem Soleimani is really the most powerful man in Lebanon. And then I was in Washington, and somebody said, it's Qasem Soleimani is really running the war in Syria. And so I kept writing his name down and saying, how do you spell that? And who is that guy? I didn't know who he was either.
How many different spellings did you get for the name?
Well, you can play with that. But you can Google his name four different ways. But once I started asking the question, once I sort of had the name, and then I started walking it around, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and those are the places I went to. I couldn't get into Iran. Everybody said, man, why didn't you ask me about him before?
Wow.
And they just kind of turned to their file and opened it up for me. So as you said, it just became this very rich thing because it turned out that he had been involved. He's been involved in sort of every pivotal event in the Middle East for the last 15 years. And he's sort of the puppet master. And so it's very rare that everything works out that nicely.
And so you shared that information with David Remnick at The New Yorker, and he said, go tell the story, of course. Is that how it
yeah,
works?
But I,
or no?
David's very indulgent of me, and because, you know,
why
I basically, what I was saying to David essentially was, I have this kind of vague idea about this guy whose name I can't spell, and I think he's really powerful, and I need about $20,000 in 4 months to go figure out who he is and what he's doing. And I said to David, I said, this guy, you know, there's these old Cold War novels by John le Carré. And the main, very shadowy Soviet spy master is named Carla, and I said, David, I think this is Carla. I think it's Carla.
Wow, wow.
And David, of course, the bell went immediately. He used to live in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
He said, do it, just go. And then I was like, oh my God. So I took the money and ran. But
and it took you 4 months to put all the pieces together.
Yeah, it took a long time. It was embarrassing how long it took me.
But you mean it took you that long over there, not at home, to put it together, but rather you were spending that much time in the Middle East kind of trailing this story and talking to as many people as you could?
I think it was about 4 months from start to finish. I went to Israel, as I said. So basically I looked for people. And there were a lot of people. I look for people who don't like him, because he's been behind assassinations and bombings and destabilizing governments. So there are a lot of people who really hate him. And so, for instance, if you can get to, say, somebody in Israeli intelligence and say, what do you got on Qasem Soleimani? You know, they're gonna lighten up. You know, they're gonna say, let's go to the vault.
Wow.
It doesn't always happen that way.
And is there ever a conflict for you about what information to share? I think you talk once about often knowing more than officials and soldiers. And when do you decide to share that information? Because I think it must be complicated to just use it for, I don't mean just for storytelling, but, you know, especially now that you're at The New Yorker rather than... So how do you make those decisions?
Well, I mean, whether you're at a newspaper or magazine, you want to share everything. I mean, we're sort of in the business of sharing information. So really, you're only going to hold back something. Those cases are pretty rare. But for instance, let's say you're when I was embedded with the Marines before they went into Fallujah, which was turned out to be the biggest battle of the Iraq War. I knew that was coming. I guess a day beforehand they gave us a briefing and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going in tomorrow night. If we were to write that, then that would basically tip off
right.
The bad guys and then get a lot of people killed. And so that's not something, you know, that's something that you're going to say, okay, look, we're making a judgment here that we're not in the business of getting people killed. So we'll withhold something like that. But it's rare.
And this quote that I read, you wrote in the New York Times Sunday Book Review last month, you wrote, in war, even boredom is strange. given all you've just said.
Lots of boredom.
In what sense?
Everything is, when you're in a war zone, and that was a review of this fabulous book by Phil Kly, who's a former Marine. The book's called Redeployment. But I think when you're in a war zone, as I said, most of the time nothing's happening. You're just standing around, and everything is strange. Everything seems slightly off, and it's certainly off when people are getting killed. But I think it's because the stakes are so high. People's lives are hanging in the balance. Things are changing. Everything is up in the air. Everything that, say, would form a society, whether it's a government or a state or some institution. All the large questions that were answered in America 200 years ago are up in the air. And so you're just kind of you're in this really strange place, and you're kind of waiting for the guns to go off. And that does something to your psyche. It just bends and twists it around, and the world's never the same after that.
Okay. I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Dexter Filkins about covering wars around the world. He's reported from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, and he's the author of the book, The Forever War. And we'll have more after a break. Hi, I'm Sarah Jessica Parker in today for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dexter Filkins. Okay, Dexter, this is a very strange question. I'm very interested in what you wish people would talk about when you return. That I wonder sometimes if we get caught up in speaking with a person like yourself about, has this engagement been a success, a failure? And we talk about the politics, but how do you wish the conversation would go? And what do you want to talk about, or do you not want to talk about it with uninformed people like me?
No, I think any question's good. I think that when I come back from one of these places, I'm not normal at all. So I wouldn't blame anybody for either not talking to me or, asking
me a strange
question.
And what do you mean not normal? Sort of what you just described previous, this sort of alternate universe of where everything is slightly, I think you said, twisted in some way, that feels not normal to you.
Yeah, it's like you've been in another solar system for a long time, and you're coming back to Earth. And so, the most consequential decision you're going to make that day is what kind of cheese to put on your sandwich. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, when you come back to that, and, where 2 weeks ago you were deciding, whether to go down this road or not, and the people who did got killed and the people who didn't survive, mm-hmm. It has its effect. And so I think, to answer your question, I think that any question's good. I think what's most jarring is when you come back and nobody cares. That you don't get any questions. So and I certainly understand, my God, we've been at war in Afghanistan for 12 years and the Iraq war was a nightmare. Nonetheless, these were, great national endeavors, and people were dying every day. And I think what was most unsettling to me was just how disconnected the country was, and the country is, from both of these wars.
And do you think it's disconnected because of what you've just said? It's just the length of the engagement and how painful it is sometimes to just think about the loss, think about the investments made, obviously, the human investment, the financial. I mean, why do you imagine us to be disengaged in some way?
I think the answer is that most Americans don't have a stake in this war. They don't know anyone who's been fighting it, mm-hmm. and they don't have to pay for it. And so it's kind of an abstraction. So it's just something that you hear on the news every now and then, or maybe you talk about at dinner. But because there's no draft, it's just basically, guys from little towns or the officer corps, which is a very small number of people. So I think it's actually about 1% of the population. We always hear about the 1%, but there's actually a different 1%, which is the 1% of the Americans who, 3 million or so, who have gone in and out of these wars, and it's them and their families. But unless you are them, what's your connection?
Right.
No higher taxes, no nothing.
Right.
So these wars don't mean very much to most people. And that's the hardest thing to deal with, because they're real. They're very real.
Yeah. And do you feel a personal investment in the outcome? You've made these connections. You talk about the lives that, our men and women who are serving, and obviously all the people you've met, the translators, the facilitators, all those people. What do you feel an investment in, even just in terms of continuing to cover? Like, how, do these stories remain interesting? Are they so because of those people? Do you care about the political outcome? Is there a scenario that you find most ideal? It's a lot of questions. But
no.
My first day.
I think when you're on the ground in one of these countries, whether they're Americans engaged there or not, and I'm thinking, say, for instance, Lebanon, which is this incredibly beautiful country, very small, only 4 million people, but every current and every road in the Middle East goes through there. I'll give you an example. A couple years ago, I went over there to do a story on Hezbollah, which is the armed group that's kind of created by the Iranians and now fighting in Syria, but was mainly sort of developed to fight Israel. Lebanon's a beautiful and amazing place, and the people are great. And you get to know people. And so, for instance, I was interviewing a member of parliament named Mohammed Chatta, and he had been he spoke perfect English. He'd studied in the United States. He was the Lebanese ambassador to the United States. He was killed in a car bomb a couple months ago. And that happens a lot. But when you sit, you know, when you go to these countries and you sit with these people, you realize, you know, they're but for the grace of God, mm-hmm. right? They're real and they're human just like the rest of us. And that's what keeps you going. It's just the human connections that you make when you're over there.
And, you know, recently there's been at least, I think, two or three people, journalists, in the last month or so who have been killed, I think one of whom or two of whom you were friendly with from the Associated Press. I'm imagining that these are not the first you've known, and that how does one accommodate these losses when they're accumulating, and does that influence your decision over time to return? You know, is there some sort of danger calculus that you maintain? And when did this become so dangerous for journalists?
Well, those are all really good questions. I think you're referring to there's a woman named Anya mm-hmm. Niedringhaus, who was a wonderful woman, who was a photographer for the Associated Press. She was killed just a couple weeks ago in Afghanistan, along with Kathy Gannon, a Canadian reporter for the Associated Press. And Kathy, I know both of them very well. And, you know, they were just, I mean, they were like covering the election and they were sitting in their car and they were actually killed by an Afghan police officer. He just took his gun and he saw them. And, you know, they're women, who knows, but you know, they're Western, they're women, who knows what was going through his head, but he just took his gun and killed them. And then, Kathy was wounded, killed Anya. And he just handed his guns to, you know, just turned around and handed his guns to his colleagues and walked off. I mean, he was arrested. But I think since 2011, since 9/11, since 2001, I think I've lost about 18 friends, people I knew, journalists who I knew. That's a
since
lot of people.
Since 2011, you said?
Since 2001. Since 9/11.
Wow.
Long
yeah.
time. So if you go through the, you know, Afghan war and the Iraq war.
More than
war,
one a year.
Then, yeah, and it's weird. I mean, I sort of, when I think of that, and I think of all the people that I know who've been killed, it's almost as though right after 9/11, they got a big room full of journalists together and said, okay, you know, you're all going to spend the next 10 years chasing this thing, and it's going to be really amazing and super interesting and really thrilling. But a lot of you look around because a lot of you aren't going to make it. Because, you know, like 18 people is a lot of people. And those are just ones I know.
I'm Sarah Jessica Parker, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker. So there is, you've described, I mean, sort of briefly, there's a camaraderie that exists among journalists, I would think. I mean, you're all after the same story. There must be some competitive yeah. camaraderie as well. What is that like? How does the day, you know, I know that you run sometimes when you're away, or maybe you ran one time and wrote about it. No, you run. But, you know, you set up a life in some way. And yeah. like all of us, there is the end of our day, no matter what time it is, I guess. And, I mean, I imagine, you know, a bunch of, you know, these images from movies, you all gather around a bar and you're sharing drinks and talking about, you know, wiping dust from your eyes and pulling out your note. What is that camaraderie like? It is competitive, of course, but there must be some connection that only you all can understand.
Yeah, I mean, but it's really you mentioned the movies. It's really romanticized. It's mostly competitive, and so but it's when you're in one of these places, it's not normal in any way, and it's kind of destructive to you and to your relationships and to your friendships, because it's such an extreme experience and it's very isolating. You're away from everybody else. You're in this kind of world that most people can't understand. And so it's true. You have each other, and everybody tends to work too much and not sleep enough and drink too much and all that. But I have really, really good friends from those days and from those places. But
it's not like you all go home. Are they not maintained? They sort of serve a purpose while you're there?
No, they are, but they're made under really strange circumstances.
Right.
But and it's just, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not a life that's really sustainable over a long period of time.
And when you said it's hard to maintain relationships and have a personal life. So when you are away, do you miss home, or do you kind of shut it off? Do you say, I can't, that doesn't exist for me now? If it's too impossible to conduct relationships, and what do you do? And are you making a conscious choice to sacrifice one for the other? And how do you decide which one won? You know, that time when it gets really to those really important relationships that
right,
are suffering.
Right. Well, I think at least in my case, and I got divorced when I was in Iraq. You don't imagine that you're making a choice at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens is that the experience is so intense and it's so large. It's very enormous. The stakes are really high. You imagine that your place in this thing is very crucial, whether it is or not.
Mm.
You think you're really important. And so you can't leave because it's too, again, it's like you're breathing pure oxygen.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, everything else starts to shrink. And that's what I mean. It's not a normal experience.
Yeah.
And so even when you come out, you know, you say, well, why do I have to balance my checkbook?
Right,
you know, because people are dying over there.
Right.
And that's it just distorts everything. And so if you come out from some crazy place and, you know, your friends are wondering what happened to you and where you been,
yeah.
You know? And
can you talk a little bit about how you do or do not communicate with people while you're away and how you set up some system for safety? And I was so sort of stunned to hear that there's not more of a daily check-in.
No, you just disappear.
That sounds terrifying for family and those closest
yes.
to you.
I think when you're here, it looks like, you know, those places look like they're on fire all the time.
All day long, yeah.
You know, and they're not. But if you're, I think certainly if you're a...
But when you're chasing a Soleimani and you're, or maybe that's not the best example, but when you're after a story that... You're dealing with some people, I would imagine, who are rather unsavory and certain. Maybe they pose dangers to you. So if people at home aren't aware, you know, tell my son, make sure, you know, when you land at your destination, give me a ring.
Well,
isn't somebody at home saying the same thing to you in some way?
Of course. But I'm even like just on a professional level. My very good friend, Susan Shira, who was the foreign editor of the New York Times for most of the time that I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, I always wondered, like, man, like all the crazy lunatic stuff I'm doing and nearly getting killed and doing all this. And I know that she thought about it. And you know, she kept her phone on and took phone calls all through the night from anybody who called. And, you know, the Times has, you know, offices all over the world. But I think as an editor, when you send... one of these reporters into one of these places, you have to be pretty sure of their judgment because chances are pretty good that something's going to happen to you, even if your judgment's good.
Right.
But just to give an example of how crazy it is, I remember it at the height of the Iraq war, I think every time the New York Times sent a reporter into Iraq, the life insurance premiums were $15,000 a month per person.
Wow.
So if we had, imagine, I mean, if we had... five or six reporters in the country only, and a couple of photographers, they were paying $100,000 a month just to insure them. And the payout was not enormous if you were killed. And so you didn't have to be like a math genius to figure out that the actuary back at the insurance office had
that
basically
like
decided somebody
musical.
Was going to get killed. Yeah, it's crazy. And I you know, actually, I keep going to the Middle East and all that, but I haven't done anything. I had a really bad experience. It's like 5 years ago now.
You describe a scene in 2003 when you went to get some kebabs, the tip of the Sunni Triangle. This isn't even the bad one you're talking about outside the green zone, is it? That one that we...
No, there's so many.
Oh, there's so many. Where to begin? It's a laundry list.
But I had a really bad experience in Afghanistan in 2009. And nothing happened to me, but a lot of guys that I was with got killed and wounded, and it was nuts. It was crazy, and I actually got on the satellite phone, and called New York and said, I think I'm going to come out.
Yeah,
I'm not going to stay. And they don't make you stay.
Right.
You know, it's up to you.
And so, why do you? You don't go back with the same frequency, but you're still engaged in some way. Is it hard when you get a reputation like yours, a great reputation, and you win important awards in your field, to extricate yourself from telling these stories? There must be so many other things you want to talk about that interest you. Well, I want you to talk about them. I'm interested in you talking about them. So, you know, how do you... Do you want to maintain a foot in that part of the world, and or there are other areas that you are really wanting to investigate and write about?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. It's kind of a curse, actually, because the Middle East is so complicated and it's so bizarre and it's so weird that on your best day, you're in a snowstorm looking at this kind of foggy thing at the other end of a field and wondering if it's a bear or a wolf or something. And that's as much clarity as you ever get in the Middle East. And I've been going in and out of there for a long time, and I kind of understand it. I know a lot of people there. I think I'm reasonably good at sort of figuring out what happened. That's hard enough. And so inevitably I get sort of pulled back into it. Sometimes I pull myself. Sometimes my bosses do. No, but I have like lots of other things I want to do. But that's kind of what happens, because it's like, you know, Iraq's on fire. Like, who are we going to send? You know. So I feel like kind of jihad boy some days. I wish I weren't.
Well, we're really grateful for all you've done, for telling the stories the way you have. I personally hope that you stay interested but safe, but that I look forward to everything you'll be doing in the future. And I'm enormously grateful for your time here today. It's been a real privilege, and I hope I didn't hurt your career in any way by you coming here. I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer, the great Dexter Filkins, about covering wars around the world and his life when he's doing it. He's reported from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. He's also the author of the bestseller, The Forever War. Dexter, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Up next, painter, sculptor, and printmaker Alex Katz talks about his long career, and in our second hour, playwright Terrence McNally on his play Mothers and Sons, along with Tyne Daly and Frederick Weller, who star in the production. I'm Sarah Jessica Parker in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.